Hello, everyone, and welcome to The Upward Spiral, a music business podcast presented by Hypebot.com. Today on the podcast, I am talking with Larry Rosen, who is the co-founder and president of Edison Research, a New Jersey-based market research firm. We are going to talk about how the way people listen to music has changed and what this means for traditional radio stations and digital music services. I am Kyle Berlin, a user researcher at SoundHound, a music ID and search app. I'm also the author of the book Promised Land, Youth Culture, Disruptive Startups, and the Social Music Revolution. As I said at the top of the show, I am joined by Larry Rosen. Say hello, Larry.
Good afternoon.
So Larry, back in June of 2014, Edison Research published its first ever share of ear study. Billboard's Glenn Peoples reported that the study filled a gap in understanding about Americans' listening habits. No market research company had tracked the aggregate amount of audio music consumers regularly consume. When did the need to fill this gap become apparent to you, and how did you go about conducting that study?
Yeah, so the story is that for years, I would take a phone call where someone would say to me, what is the share of everything in the audio space? How can one compare the size of broadcast radio to, say, streaming audio, things like Pandora and Spotify, even to things like people's owned music files, Sirius XM, or any such thing? You know, what is the size of each? And to my frustration, my answer was always, I don't know the answer, and I don't think anybody knows the answer to that question. So it finally dawned on me after, you know, years of being asked this question and not knowing the answer that maybe I should just do a study to answer this question. This is clearly the market saying there's an opportunity there. So we decided to put it out there and talk to some potential clients about it. I'm happy to say so far it's gone really well. There's a lot of client interest, and we're going to continue to carry on this research. In terms of how we went about doing it, we had a nationally representative sample of a little over 2,000 people, ages 13 and older, fill out a one-day, very comprehensive listening diary. So people were assigned a specific 24-hour period. A seventh each of the sample were given each day of the week. So Monday got a seventh, Tuesday a seventh, et cetera. And the people filled out a diary, everything they listened to from 6 o'clock in the morning all the way around to 6 o'clock in the morning the next day. And we broke the day up into 96 15-minute chunks and asked people to fill out what they listened to for all 96 of those chunks, if you will, in order to be considered a successful and complete interview. And people would tell us what they listened to in terms of what the platform of audio was. And then they would also tell us what device they consumed it on. What kind of content it was. Was it music? Was it news? Was it sports? Was it talk? And their location. Were they at home? Were they at work? Were they in their car? Or were they somewhere else? So they gave us a ton of information for each of the times that they listened. So in total, we got an enormous amount of data. And it allows us to show, on average, how Americans share their audio time.
What are some of the most important findings that emerged from this share of ear study?
Right. So the big findings, I think, related mostly to the platform of listening. What do people say that they listen to in terms of the different platforms? And what we found was that broadcast radio, AM/FM radio, remains the big major source of audio usage. More than half of all the listening that people did was to broadcast radio, AM/FM radio, a little over half, about 52%. After that, well behind was owned music. People spent about 20% of their time with music that they own. And then streaming audio came in behind that at 12%. And we also showed percentages for things like Sirius XM, TV music channels like Music Choice, and podcasts, and a variety of other smaller platforms.
To me, that is one of the striking things about that study, is how it runs in contrast with the narrative that you see written online about the music industry, which is that AM/FM radio is almost never discussed. It's, you know, almost perceived to be weak or dead. You know, people always say, well, no one listens to traditional radio anymore, which clearly isn't true. It's almost like the evangelism for these digital music services doesn't align with actual reality.
Well, I mean, that's a regular theme in this world where it's sort of the chattering classes are very different in behavior from real people, if you will. And what those people are really saying when they say no one listens to radio anymore is that they don't listen to radio anymore. But in point of fact, you know, by far, in terms of reach, in terms of the percentage of people who reported any listening time at all during their diary day, radio was miles ahead of anything else. And of course, there's some people who listen to very little radio or no radio at all. But still, radio is hardly dead yet. It is not the only game in town like it once was, but it's still formidable and still there's a reason that everyone still wants to hear the records on the radio.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So in your most recent share of your report, your firm found that American teens now spend more time with streaming audio services such as Pandora and Spotify than they do with AM, FM radio. Why is this finding so significant?
Well, there's a variety of things going on here. Of course, today's teenagers are true digital natives, as they're called. You know, they're young people who can't comment about before the internet or what life was like before the internet, or in many cases, even before smartphones came along. And so they have had access to newer technologies their whole lives. They live lives that are entirely submersed in digital options. And it makes sense that they would gravitate towards many of these new delivery forms for audio. By the same token, it's something I wrote about recently, very, very few radio stations actually directly target teenagers. While plenty of radio stations get a lot of listening by teenagers, you know, top 40 radio stations all over the country and country music stations and others, virtually none of them actually target teenagers as a sales target or marketing target. And so part of this is just you reap what you sow. If you're not trying to get teenagers, it would make sense that you don't do so well at getting teenagers. So that's clearly a factor.
I found that to be an interesting part of your blog post. You stated that virtually no radio stations do research into the teen audience, and so few of them, especially in the U.S., are trying to target that market with their marketing efforts. And where you kind of grew skeptical is this idea that these teens would magically grow into radio as they aged and pursued further education and started your careers. I believe you characterized this as the greatest challenge that radio stations may ever face.
Yes. I mean, it is hardly impossible to imagine that teens will grow into AM, FM radio, but not without the radio business trying to get them to do so. They won't just magically start tuning to the radio after a lifetime up to that point of listening to so much less radio or no radio at all. When radio managers sit around and strategize, that's kind of a more global effort than they're typically taking on. Now, radio does have some really big companies within it. Obviously, the former Clear Channel, which is now called iHeart, and Cumulus and CBS and others. And any one of them individually or the medium working together in the ways that they legally can could engage in various marketing efforts. But I wouldn't count on it. I doubt that that will become a major effort on their part, even though it should.
Mm-hmm. Another interesting thing you said in that release is that this could be a lens into the future of audio usage. Can you expand on that?
Well, I'm just saying that per what we were just discussing, that it's questionable whether people will age into radio over time. So if you look at our data, teenagers are the only group where AM, FM is not the biggest area of listening. Even just go to the adjacent 18 to 24-year-olds, and you'll see that radio is way out ahead of streaming audio. But every successive age group, radio gets higher and higher. So while 18 to 24 year olds is a lot higher than teenagers for radio, 25, 34s are higher than the 18 to 24 year olds, and 35, 44s than the 25, 34 year olds, and on and on. Radio does better and better as people get older and older. I do not think this is a function of people liking radio more as they age. I think this is a function of younger people. The younger you are, the more likely you are to have explored other options for audio consumption. And so, if this group is listening to much less radio now, it's not unlikely that as they age, they'll continue to listen to less radio. Every day, a teenager becomes a young adult. And, you know, we're going to presumably see a lot of those things carry forward. It's just not that long ago where the options for audio consumption were basically radio and owned music, largely on CDs, or before that on vinyl. Now there's just so many more options, right? You can listen to streaming audio. You can access SiriusXM. You can bring in music channels through your television on things like Music Choice through cable systems or satellite. You can download digital files like digital speech-based files like podcasts. You can listen to audio books. You can do so many more things with audio than you used to be able to do. And naturally, that's going to squeeze down some of the time that was spent with the incumbents. Now, all that said, on top of that is our evidence that people are spending more time with audio, period, that having all these options is bringing audio to more parts of their day. So it's a dynamic space, you know, that people are changing within in terms of the choices they're making, and they're simply spending more time with audio because technology is bringing audio into more places in their lives.
With that, though, do you think audio is at the forefront of the experience or a background to an activity that they're currently doing?
Well, traditionally, the overwhelming majority of audio usage, whether it was from radio or your owned music or nowadays with newer technologies, it has always been, and it is still the case, that the overwhelming majority of audio usage is done while doing something else, whether it's walking the dog or exercising or gardening or driving or working or any of a million other things. Most audio usage is background usage. I mean, obviously, the days of people staring at their radio to listen to a show or listen to content like they did in the 1940s or early 1950s are long since gone. And even when people are listening to podcasts, which one might surmise would be a very involving behavior, even in that case, we find that most people are doing something else at the same time, whether it's, like I said, driving or taking a shower or who knows what they're doing. That is the nature of audio. It's something that fills in the gaps in people's lives and makes their lives more fulfilling and more pleasurable. But it's seldom the primary activity to the exclusion of anything else.
That's interesting that you characterize that as the nature of audio, that it's rarely the primary activity. Only recently, in recent years, did Songza, the curated playlist startup, really tap into this idea that at different times of day, people might be looking for different kinds of music. And if you make it really simple to bring up that curated playlist for that activity or mood, people will find a lot of delight in that experience.
Right. But even then, I would bet if you talk to the people at Songza or now Google, their research would show that while they are doing that very interesting activity of trying to match playlists to your mood or to what you're doing, that is still overwhelmingly it's being used in conjunction or as background to some other behavior. In fact, most of the songs that playlists do speak to that other behavior, you know, while working out mm-hmm. or while getting work done or while grading papers or while whatever it is, it's sometimes just purely mood, you know, just I want to be happier. I'm in a bad mood. You know, sometimes it's purely mood service, but many of their playlists refer to the other activity.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's what I meant in what I was saying, was that they were the first company to really tap into that. Certainly we can say that, you know, people use some Pandora stations for one thing and another Pandora station for another, and that's just their natural inclination towards the service. This is what I listen to when I'm working. This is what I listen to while I'm working out. But Songza really went ahead and made that an entire part of their user experience and really influenced the way that Beats Music, Slacker Radio, and a number of services change their experience.
Right. iHeart has their Perfect Four, which is the same thing as well. Yeah, I mean, this speaks back to what I was saying earlier about it's just an exciting time in audio. There's experimentation, there's new ideas, there's new ways to think of all kinds of audio, music in particular, and ways to organize it. I think, you know, when people talk about Pandora and the wild success of Pandora, they mention a lot of things, but I think it is really underappreciated the fact and how clever it was to define radio stations around individual artists or individual songs. If, you know, the normal rubric would have been radio's rubric, right? The country station, the rock station, the top 40 station. And, you know, Pandora was started by a musician, and the fact that he looked at it in a completely different way, I think it's an underappreciated aspect to its success as well. That he said, let's not just have traditional radio stations, you know, traditionally defined. Let's allow people to define these stations the way they want to. And that's yet another example of the different ways that people are organizing things. And so there is a reason why there's interest in, say, our share of ear study, why you're on the phone with us, because the there's just a lot of fun, amazing things going on, and the consumers are, you know, getting the benefit of all the new ways that exist to think about audio and consume audio.
Does the share of ear study reveal anything about how Pandora is perceived amongst listeners?
Well, our study really isn't about perceptions so much; it's purely about behavior. So we don't ask attitudinal questions. You know, what's your attitude about these things? The share of ear study is a purely behavioral study. What are you doing? When are you doing it? On what device are you doing it? Where are you, et cetera? The answer, the short answer is no.
Okay, fair enough. So the recent report also stated that American teens spend an average of 4 hours and 2 minutes each day consuming audio. What are the other types of audio that are being listened to, and which are they in this sort of order of significance?
Yeah, so American teens do spend a lot of time with owned music. We didn't get into the how they got their hands, the provenance of that music. You know, did they pay for it? Are they file sharing? Did they rip CDs? Are they listening on? How did they buy that music? But the owned music is overwhelmingly on digital files. A small percentage is on CDs. And so American teens very much listen to a lot of owned music as well. The overwhelming majority of audio time for American teens is taken up by those three, streaming audio, owned music, and broadcast radio. And again, broadcast radio is not hardly a zero. It's a significant chunk of listening for teenagers, especially in cars. It's a very rapidly changing. Teens, as you might guess, or wouldn't be surprised to learn, spend a lot less time with things like SiriusXM and podcasts, which really tend to be targeted for a little bit older people.
Given the predominance of owned music as it relates to share of ear, where do you think things are in terms of the shift of the long heralded shift from ownership to accessed music?
Yeah, I wish every day that I had done the study 10 years ago or 15 or 20 years ago so I could compare the changes over time. I mean, our plan is very much to keep tracking it going forward. Like I said earlier, there's a lot of client interest, and so we'll be certainly tracking through 2015. And so I'm left to guess or speculate what the same graph would have looked like 10 years ago or 15 or 20 years ago. And there's no doubt that some of that is going on, that shift from owned music to, you know, particular Spotify or streaming music services that give you sort of the benefits of owned music without actually having to, drop your money on specific CDs or even specific digital files, et cetera. But I don't really have the tracking on that. That's the plan for going forward, right? We can see if that shift continues to happen. We can see how quickly it's happening, among whom is it happening. But we won't have the, we can't really look backwards on that. I think it is a good guess that the trend to acquire less music that you own will continue. But again, ours is more to chronicle that than it is to predict that into the future.
I think that's very interesting that to date, your firm is the first to look at those two audio sources side by side, both, you know, broadcast radio, owned music, and digital music services. And that only now do we truly have a sense of the shift that is happening, as opposed to the shift we perceive to be happening due to the emergence of these services and the increase of their subscriber numbers over the last 10 years.
Yep. And like I said, it's going to be fascinating to continue to watch. The space is very dynamic. I don't doubt that we'll have to add new things as new technologies come along that I'm not creative enough to think of. Things really are shifting. I mean, you know, when you talk to certain Spotify users, I mean, one of the things they love about it is, you know, for many of these people, they used to spend $100 a month on, you know, for the really avid music consumer, they were spending $100 a month on acquiring CDs or, you know, combination of CDs and digital music files, whatever. So Spotify comes along and says, well, I can basically give you access to every song ever recorded pretty much for $10 a month. I mean, it's incredibly efficient for that person. Now, certainly in the short term, the music industry loses out on that deal, right? Going from having, $1,200 of revenue down to, you know, $120 of revenue. That's a big part of what we're seeing so far with Spotify users is it's, you know, an incredibly efficient way for them to have access to even more music than they had and save a ton of money in the process.
Mm-hmm. I know you haven't released these stats yet, but what about the trends that were emerging amongst all other age groups in the study in terms of share of ear?
Yeah, well, I mentioned earlier that the older you get, the better AM/FM radio does, which makes a certain amount of sense. You also see shifts in terms of, I mentioned that we asked people what kind of audio did you listen to? Was it music? Was it news? Was it talk and personalities? Or was it sports? A little bit less so with sports, but news and talk also do better the older you get. Music is totally dominant in all age groups, but just a little bit less dominant the older you get. More and more listening goes to news and talk as you get older. You're looking at not just tastes, but really you're probably looking at technology. Right. The younger you are, the more likely you are to have a smartphone, the more likely you are to keep that smartphone almost like attached to your body at all times and make it almost the center of your existence. And people's behavior on smartphone is very different from, say, a person in their 50s who works in a cubicle or in the office or something like that, as you might imagine. So in some ways, we're showing changes in preference, but in many ways, we're just showing changes in technology.
Mm-hmm. I believe in a related study, there is also a huge uptake in podcast listening as well.
Well, podcasts, of course, are clearly having their moment in the sun. It's a concept that's been around for a while. I think it got the name podcasts in 2004. And, you know, the idea of mostly speech-based digital music files that you could listen to whenever you wanted to, as opposed to, you know, turning on the radio and just sort of dipping your cup into the stream of audio as it went past you. People have been theorizing for a long time that moment was going to come. And it certainly seems as though that moment came in the fall when for the first time the medium kind of popped a hit. You know, just like, and I compare it a lot to 18 to 24 months ago, you'd be at a cocktail party and someone would say, "Hey, are you watching Orange is the New Black?" And the next person would say, "What's that?" And they'd say, "Oh, it's a show that's streaming on Netflix." And in many cases, the person would say, "What's Netflix?" Or what do you mean streaming on Netflix? I thought that was sending people DVDs, et cetera. And sort of the conversation engaged. It could have been about House of Cards as well. And, you know, maybe the wife would turn to the husband at that same cocktail party and say, "We need to set this up in our house. Show me, let's figure out how to stream Netflix into our home." And Netflix, you know, really got this boost because it had hits. It had House of Cards and especially Orange is the New Black. And you felt a lot of that last fall with Serial, the sort of hit podcast from the people at National Public Radio, the people behind This American Life. And all of a sudden, you heard people talking about a podcast, something that never happened before. And the conversation was typically similar. "Have you listened to Serial? What's Serial? It's a podcast. What's a podcast?" You explain what a podcast is and they say, "I'm going to figure out how to consume a podcast, whether through my computer or, you know, downloading the files onto my phone and listening in my car or what have you." So all of a sudden, you know, the column inches, whether, you know, physical and newspapers are more likely digital column inches, talking about podcasting as a medium, using Serial as the hook, it just completely exploded in the fall. And we're seeing the early results of that. We had much higher results for podcasts, still small, but much higher in the fall than we did in the spring study. You can just feel, and you can feel the buzz around podcasts. And I can, with some level of confidence, predict that is going to continue to grow. You know, what we saw, the changes we've seen in the last 6 months will likely continue at least for some period of time, because right now there's an enormous amount of energy and dollars being invested in new podcasts, new podcast ideas, new production, new ways for people to sort of disconnect their audio usage from time and listen when and where they want to, very much like people have been doing now for years with a TiVo or DVR, or increasingly now with streamed video.
Absolutely. I mean, I followed Serial closely, just like everyone else. It almost brought me back to the time of waiting for music on Tuesdays. Instead, I was waiting for Serial on Thursdays. And, you know, it definitely became a topic of conversation with everyone. And it's interesting that the crime drama, of all things, took off, that was the big hit with everyone.
Yeah, I mean, certainly the crime was part of it. I think you have to look at the storytelling acumen of Sarah Koenig and the way she wrote the story with her team, as well as the way she delivered her story. The whole package was just there, and it was compelling. And yeah, millions of people all over the world were waiting for Thursday. And there was sort of a tingly excitement every Thursday morning when you checked your phone to see that the new Serial episode had been downloaded. And that's the kind of excitement that is exceptionally rare in radio or any kind of audio, save for the drop of a big album like you imply with the Tuesday mention. And but for speech-based audio, it's really almost unheard of, unless you go back to, you know, the first age of radio, you know, people sitting, making sure they were sitting by their radios, you know, at a certain time and on a certain date in order to listen to their favorite radio shows.
It's interesting, you know, anecdotally, when I was growing up, I'd always get in my dad's car when he picked me up from school, and he'd be listening to talk radio, and he'd be like, "Oh, Dad, I want to listen to NPR. I want to listen to the pop radio." And, you know, now, you know, 10 some years later, I'm listening to a ton of talk radio. It occupies a large part of my listening behavior, almost appending the time I would have maybe spent listening to music, which I think is interesting. Like, a lot of my car time is now spent listening to podcasts instead of consuming music.
Right. And we're just starting to pick some of that stuff up. I mean, you know, again, the tracking and trending is only just beginning on this project. So mostly what we have is anecdotal stuff like what you just described. We are looking at it and tracking it. And you do hear an awful lot of what you just said on that anecdotal basis. Once people could realize how easy it was and how compelling it is to listen to speech-based radio on their schedule, as opposed to just tuning in your local public radio station and hearing whatever story they're talking about at that time, it you know, throws the control to you to hear about what you're interested in when you're interested in hearing it. So if you're a Alabama college football fan, there's podcasts about Alabama football specifically for you. I know a fellow with an extremely successful podcast about whiskey and other hard liquors. And, you know, if that's an interest or passion of yours, hey, you can listen. I mean, obviously, that's never going to be on the radio. It's way too specific a topic to be on broadcasting. But if that's the kind of targeted narrow cast of interest to you, you want to be able to hear it, and you want to be able to hear it when you're available to hear it. And so once you sort of get it with podcasting, it really has the potential to change your behavior very dramatically. And frankly, with the smartphone, for many people, it's now really, really easy to do, and getting easier as new cars roll off the lot that automatically sync via Bluetooth and allow you to manipulate the playback through your touchscreen on your dashboard, things of that nature. So as it gets easier, it's, again, easy to project into the future the likelihood that more of it's done.
Mm-hmm. So we've been speaking a lot about your share of ear study and other studies that are sort of available via subscription through your website. But I know that clients also approach you as well to conduct studies such as Pandora's, Spotify's, as well as other companies. Can you speak broadly about the kinds of questions you're capable of answering with the research that you do?
Well, I mean, we're a full service market research, survey research, polling operation. And so we engage in any number of different kinds of projects that sometimes are more behavioral measurements, like the one, like the share of ear study that we're talking about, but very often more attitudinal. You know, why do you like something? Why do you engage in something or do something? Why do you not like something? And, you know, et cetera. So we do lots of attitudinal or perceptual research, again, with a more strategic nature for customers who are trying to improve their product or understand their customers better. Our company has a unique capability. We are the company that does the exit polls for the U.S. television networks on election night. Most people, when they watch TV on election night, are not aware that even though NBC says, according to our NBC exit poll, or CNN says, according to our CNN exit poll, in point of fact, there's just one exit poll, and the networks pull their money together and hire one company to do that project. And we've had that project since 2003. So, you know, the presidential exit poll is the largest one-day research project performed in the world. Well, on presidential election day, we'll collect over 110,000 interviews in one day, run complex computations on that data, and send it out to the networks in real time. It's also easily the most looked at research project in the world, because people all over the world watch presidential election coverage from the United States. We've adapted that method of research to interviewing people in lots of environments. People, for instance, exiting a concert, exiting a retail store, exiting a restaurant, et cetera, and doing exit polls of a variety of kinds so that we can get, you know, we have a real expertise in getting people as they are moving around or as they leave somewhere and getting their opinions on the spot, et cetera. So we're engaged in all manner of different things. And while I can't speak specifically to the kinds of questions we're answering for our clients, again, it's usually something oriented towards how can we understand our customers together, customers better? How can we, advance strategies, test ideas and see how they might be accepted before we invest too much money in them, all kinds of things of that nature.
So how big is your company currently, based on the specific projects? Are you currently growing? If you get a big project, do you have your current team and then you contract out? How does that work in terms of sourcing?
Well, we're pretty much all full-time. We do have subcontractors who do some of the work for us. It's mostly full-time staff that is supervising and managing all our projects. I'm happy to say we're growing. We're 20 years old. I started the business in 1994, in June of 94. So we're a little over 20 and a half years old. And I'm proud to say it's pretty much been an upward slope throughout. And we continue to grow. The acquisition of that Exipol contract that I described in 2003 was clearly a bit of a pivot point for us that really, sent us up to another level. And we continue to investigate all kinds of new things, whether it be international projects or investigating new industries, new areas, et cetera. So we're up for anything.
That's really fascinating. Another thing that I'm starting to see emerge is, for example, I previously worked at Live Nation Labs, which was the concert promoter's web and mobile product division. Mm-hmm. And a position that I found myself in was leading user experience research for the company, which, would entail, determining research questions such as why do people love their favorite artists? Why would they want to favorite them on a website? And, Live Nation already had this database of people that had agreed to do user research. And we could reach out to, say, 6,000 people, send them to a survey, several hundred take it. And then I would do kind of in-depth follow-up interviews with those people and try to report back, based on 500 survey answers and about 15 phone interviews, here's what I think I know about why people love their favorite artists, the type of information that they're looking for, and how we could bring that into the website. And then once the feature had been completed, going back and saying, all right, Larry, you favorited these bands on the website. Is this the information that you want? Is it presented in the right way? What's missing here? The point of this story is that I'm starting to see these music technology companies start hiring teams of user researchers. I know Mark Tremell leads the user experience research team at Sonos. There's another guy in Stockholm that is the director of UX research for Spotify. And it's slowly emerging, but it's still very new because Pandora, for example, only has one user experience researcher in-house, and I think they started in the last 1 or 2 years. So,
the companies you're talking about are all young companies. And, they're rapidly expanding and trying to figure all these things out. And I would say, the kind of research you're talking about often is the kind of thing that is outsourced, at least at the beginning. And then you hire managers to oversee that process, et cetera. We're all figuring it out all the time. And, one thing I always say is that change is a constant and change is good for the research business. If everything were always the same, no one would need research. Mm-hmm. But luckily, nothing stays the same. And so there's always a need for inquiry and, to look at things and how they change. I think if you and I could go back and speak to radio managers 20 years ago or music industry managers 20 years ago and try to convince them that the changes that were about to happen, were going to happen, I think we would struggle terribly, even if we traveled back from the future, if you will, to convince them that the changes that were about to happen could possibly happen. Change, And yet, probably sometime in the future, you know, we'll look at today's, you know, seemingly dominant players, whether it be in the internet or wherever they might be, and some of them will have fallen, or, you know, because of disruptive ideas will come along that will change them. And so that's part of the fun, is that we get to measure that and chronicle that, like I said earlier, and note the change and try to put people in a position where at least they're working off information. It takes us all the way back to where we were, you know, a while ago in our discussion, where you said, you know, everyone says, oh, no one listens to the radio anymore, as an example. Well, it, you know, again, without research, without data, you know, that might become an accepted truth. But between Nielsen and their ratings data and a study like our Share of Ears study, you know, it shows that, you know, that's hardly true. And there's so many things like that. Nobody does this anymore or that anymore. And yet, you know, you need the data to say whether that is true or whether it isn't. And in many cases, that's sort of the more forward going people, the literati, the technorati, you know, they put out this theme that is often, you know, wildly ahead of reality.
Mm-hmm. Well, Larry, we've talked about a lot of different topics today. Is there anything else you want to share or something that's on your mind?
No, I've really enjoyed the chat, and I'm always happy to chat about any of these topics, you know, especially relating to audio and audio research. I've spent, you know, over a quarter of a century doing it, and I'm passionate about it, enjoy it, and always happy to engage on the topic.
If listeners want to look you up online on Twitter or your company, Edison Research, where can they find you?
Yeah, well, it's at Edison Research or edisonresearch.com. So Edison, like Thomas Edison, and research, you know, no periods or anything, edisonresearch.com.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Oh, happy to do it.
That's all for this episode of The Upward Spiral. Thanks to Hypebot.com for helping to put this podcast out. If you have any questions or comments, please email us at upwardspiralpodcast@gmail.com and be sure to follow us on Twitter at upwardspiralpod. And don't forget to subscribe at iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you like the show, please rate us highly and submit a review. Thank you for listening.